is Closing Arguments with Stephen Skirka on In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010.
And welcome on this beautiful summer Sunday. Thank you for being with me today. The case of Nicole Ryan was in the news again this week. And just to refresh your memory, Nicole Ryan, also Nicole Doucette, was charged as a result of hiring a hitman to kill her abusive husband. The hitman turned out to be an undercover RCMP officer, so the hit never took place. Ultimately, at the end of the court's dealing with Nicole Ryan, her charge was stayed by the Supreme Court of Canada. It was a very controversial decision, and a couple of front-page stories in the National Post this week by Brian Hutchinson, he captured some of the criticism, some of the suggestion that the Supreme Court of Canada was actually duped by Nicole Ryan. A lot of the allegations are fueled by Michael Ryan, her former husband, who suggests that he never had a chance to get his story told when the courts decided this case. So I thought we would go right to the source and get Nicole Ryan's lawyer. He's an outstanding lawyer, a friend of mine from Nova Scotia, Joel Pink. It's an exclusive interview, and I want to thank Joel for being with us in Closing Argument. Good to have you, Joel.
My pleasure, Steve.
So, Joel, I want to just play a very brief clip that really captures some of Michael Ryan's views about this case. Go ahead.
It was only her testimony, her corroborating witnesses stated when cross-examined by the Crown that it was they were basing their testimony only on what Nicole had told them, and it was all recent. It wasn't, you know, this 15-year reign of terror that she goes on about that they were testifying against. It was the recent, you know, of the last couple of months before she hired the hitman. She was shaking. She was losing weight, you know. But I had moved out of the home in December 2006. You know, she was arrested in March 2008. I was in a new relationship with my new spouse.
So, Joel, what's your response to this suggestion that the courts have been duped by your client and that this is a fallacious result?
Well, I, of course, Steve, I disagree with this 100%. Let's go back to the very first day of the trial. The first thing that had occurred before Mr. Justice Ferreira, an experienced trial judge of our Supreme Court, was that I made an application, what is known as the O'Connor application, to have a certain medical record, psychiatric report pertaining to Michael Ryan introduced as an exhibit. After hearing arguments and not being opposed, that particular exhibit was introduced as exhibit number 3. Now, following that, all witnesses for the Crown and for the defense were excluded from the courtroom. So what happens is that Mr. Ryan was not present during the course of the trial, even though on one occasion he presently he tried to have his fiance or girlfriend at the time sit in, take notes, and report back to him. Now, Mr. Ryan was on the Crown's witness list, and for some reason, and the Crown's position is that the only reason we didn't call him at the end was because we did not feel it was necessary. I think it's important for your listeners to fully understand that duress was raised from stage one. From the very first time that Ms. Ryan was in court, we made it very clear to the Crown that duress would, in fact, be our so-called defense, because when you look at self-defense, it was my opinion that we didn't have it. If you look at the Defense of Necessity Act, it was of the opinion that we didn't have it. So therefore, the only chance we had in having Ms. Ryan acquitted was trying to raise the common law defense of duress, even though duress is set out in Section 17 of the Code.
And just to interrupt you, Joel, duress would put abuse, the alleged abuse by Michael Ryan, front and center at the trial. That's the point you're making.
It was front and center. And what happened thereafter, Steve, is that Ms. Ryan did testify. There were a number of other witnesses called to corroborate exactly what she said.
About the abuse,
absolutely.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead, Joel.
No. These witnesses were aware of the situation. On one occasion, they were at his house removing furniture when he called, and I'm just guessing at the figure, something like 10 or 15 times. And so there was corroborative evidence before the trial judge to corroborate what, in fact, Ms. Ryan was saying. Further to that, of course, we had members of her family testify as to how he excluded her from family events. She became secluded from her family. Further, we had stories that came forward as to how Mr. Ryan made her do certain things, i.e. take money from the mother's bank account. And I think the amount, if I remember correctly, was about $50,000 that she took under his insistence. And then, of course, in the end, he was sued by the mother, Nicole Ryan's mother, to get the money back. So there's a long history here that corroborates what, in fact...
okay, Joel, can I ask you this? That there sure. was a finding of both psychological and physical abuse. Let's focus on the physical abuse.
No.
Was there anything to document the physical abuse, be it photographs, medical records, attendance in a hospital, eyewitness accounts of it?
The evidence was simply that at no time did he take his fist and beat her.
Mm-hmm.
That was directly from Nicole Ryan. There was evidence whereby he would pin her up against the wall, take his fist, and come close to her head. That would all amount to what we call psychological abuse. The fact that he put a gun to her head on at least, I think it was four occasions, okay? Of course, that's only done when there were two people present.
Sure.
So it's basically, the whole case really boiled down to what Nicole Ryan said, whether or not her evidence was accepted. Together, you look at the other evidence that was called, the judge had to make a finding of fact. And without any rebuttal from the Crown pertaining to these allegations, she, in fact, did have what we felt to be sufficient evidence upon at least to raise, to meet the error of reality,
sure.
The defense of the arrest.
Joel, were you surprised that the Crown didn't call Michael Ryan at trial?
Absolutely, and we were prepared for him for cross-examination.
I mean, that's a stunning development. As an experienced trial lawyer, I could tell you, I'd look at that and go, huh?
You're right. I mean, I expected, I spent over 9 hours just preparing for his cross-examination. We were ready for him.
Okay.
And we knew about his previous record. We knew about the medical report. You see, this is one of the big flaws I've seen in the reporting of the Nicole Ryan case. This trial was held in a small town called Digby, Nova Scotia. It was only covered by the French network. No one else covered it. It's all very good for writers to sit back and read transcripts, but they don't get the feel, as you know, Steve, of what is really going on in that courtroom. And you can't assess credibility by reading a transcript. But as you can see from the trial judge's decision, he accepted everything based on his observations of Nicole Ryan, based on the other evidence, and based on what we call Exhibit Number 3, which is the psychiatric report that was introduced under the O'Connor application, which shows a history by Mr. Ryan of having... anger management issues.
Joel, I know that there's currently an inquiry into the conduct of the police because the police didn't take this seriously. That was a feature of the decision that I read. I'd like to invite you to come back once that report is delivered, okay? And thank you so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure, Steve.
Thank you, Joel.
You're listening to Closing Arguments with legal analyst Stephen Skirka on News Talk 1010.
Welcome back. I'd like to welcome to the show Mark Sandler, a regular guest to Closing Argument. Good to have you on the show, Mark.
Thank you, Stephen. How are you?
Very good. We're going to talk about the George Zimmerman murder trial. It's taking place in Seminole County, Florida. I'm on the record of predicting an acquittal for George Zimmerman. If you're interested in following my views, you can follow them in the Huffington Post. I'll have another blog out tomorrow. But, Mark, I want to focus on one aspect of the case. And I had to come to you on this because in addition to being a fabulous lawyer, what I consider a master advocate, you're someone who brings humor into the courtroom as well as anyone I know, present company excluded. And
don't get me going.
And so we had this incredible moment in opening statements this week, and one of George Zimmerman's lawyers, Don West, tried to use humor. And I'm going to ask you if he did it effectively after we play this clip. So go ahead.
Sometimes you have to laugh to keep from crying. So let me, at considerable risk, let me say, I'd like to tell you a little joke. I know how that may sound a bit weird in this context under these circumstances, but I think you're the perfect audience for it. As long as you if you don't like it or you don't think it's funny or inappropriate, that you don't hold it against Mr. Zimmerman. You can hold it against me if you want, but not Mr. Zimmerman. I have your assurance you won't. Here's how it goes. Knock, knock. Who's there? George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman, who? All right, good. You're on the jury.
So, Mark, rating that from a 1 to 10, what would you score that joke?
Well, based upon how funny it is, it probably ranks from 0 to 1. But based upon its appropriateness at that juncture in the trial, I'd give it a negative.
Yeah, I mean, this is a murder trial. The parents of a young teenager who died are sitting in the front row. There's emotion. It's the start of the trial. You're trying to establish rapport with the jury, and there you go up. I mean, even a good joke, Mark, wouldn't have been appropriate in the opening. Don't you agree?
Well, you've got to understand something. Some people don't know how to tell a joke. He's obviously one of them. But leave that aside. You don't use humor in a case where someone has died until, at the very least, you've established your credibility with a jury. In other words, the prosecutor here delivered a dynamic, hard-hitting, focused opening address, and this is the response. The response is to tell a knock-knock joke. And why? Is that establishing credibility with the jury? Does it make them more likable? Certainly not. Does it demonstrate how seriously Mr. Zimmerman takes the fact that someone is dead as a result of the interaction with this young boy? Certainly not. So bad timing, bad joke, bad judgment. We'll see how it all plays out. Hopefully this won't be the determining factor as to how the jury deals with
it. Well, I'm going to ask you about that after the break, because he actually asked the jury not to hold it against his client. So let's talk about it when we come back, Mark. The time is now 4:20. I'm Steve Skirka, and you're listening to Closing Argument.
Closing Arguments with lawyer and analyst Steven Skirka continues on In-Depth Radio, News Talk 1010.
Knock, knock. Who's there? George Zimmerman. George Zimmerman, who? All right, good. You're on the jury.
All right, so I'm back talking with Mark Sandler about the knock-knock joke and the Zimmerman trial. If you missed the first part of the interview, that's where Mark conceded that I'm funnier than him in court. Mark, I wanted to ask you about the setup of Don West in this joke, because he goes his way to say, look, don't hold this against my client. But you know that if Zimmerman is found guilty, critics are going to point to that knock-knock joke as the beginning of the defense downfall. You think it can be held against the defense by the jury?
Oh, sure, it can be held against the defense. Jurors tend to associate everything the defense counsel does with the accused. But more to the point, he's lost a vital opportunity. See, the really good lawyer cloaks his client with his own respectability. So if the jury respect and admire the defense counsel, then the defendant gets the benefit of that. Here you've got a defense counsel that has spent so much valuable time in his opening address trying to distance himself from the client in the event that the joke bombs, that he's missing an opportunity to build rapport with the jury, to associate himself with the client. And for what purpose? To tell this joke? How did it advance Mr. Zimmerman's interest? How did this joke advance Mr. Zimmerman's interest? Indeed, I would make an argument. What is the message that the joke tells the jury? I mean, I don't want to get too serious.
I don't
about
even
a joke.
Get the joke, Mark. I have to tell you, I don't even understand it.
Well, the joke is supposed to be that all you need is a juror who's never heard of George Zimmerman, and you're going to be on the jury. The problem is,
heard of him.
Yeah, they've all heard of him, but more to the point, what you try to communicate to a jury in the jury selection process, certainly in the United States, is that these people have been carefully chosen because they're best suited to hear this case. So what is the joke conveying? The joke's conveying that only dummies who had never even heard of the case have been placed on the jury. So he's not only insulting the jury, he's advancing a joke that has no objective whatsoever other than to humor people.
You know, Mark, we've done a lot of trials together. Could you imagine one of us standing up and trying anything that unconventional and not sharing it with your co-counsel and getting his or her view first? I mean, that to me is one of the remarkable features of this, too. Clearly, Mark O'Meara, his co-counsel, didn't have a clue that this was going to happen.
Well, I guess the joke's on him.
Yeah, well, I bet Mark O'Meara is going to be doing the closing argument. Mark, let's talk about when you do use humor in the courtroom effectively, because, you know, people look at criminal trials and they think they're always just as serious as this one. So how can you ever inject, as an advocate, humor effectively as a tool of persuasion? But you can use it, can't you?
Well, of course you can use it. And, you know, there was one speaker that prefaced his comments by saying, it's my job to talk and yours to listen. And if you finish before I do, please let me know.
Yeah.
And the point that he was making is that you're not going to persuade anybody of anything if they're not listening to you. So sometimes a little bit of humor goes a long way to inject some interest, to keep people excited about what it is that's being said, and to build rapport with the listener. But I will not introduce humor with a jury at the very outset of a case. They've got to get to know me. They've got to trust me. They've got to recognize that I indeed appreciate the seriousness of the matter, particularly in a homicide. And then as the case progresses, they can see that a little bit of humor that's injected in the process isn't meant to belittle anybody. It isn't meant to deprecate the seriousness of the proceedings that are taking place. It's designed really to relieve tension.
And usually, especially in a jury trial, Mark, as you said earlier, you want to have some rapport with the jury, that you want them to know you as a human being, so then you can engage some self-disparaging humor. I remember I once spilled the water all over my notes and told them that was going to be good for the jury because I didn't have any notes of cross-examination anymore, and they laughed at that. You know, so you do want to season those moments, but you couldn't tell that in the first hour of a trial.
No, of course you can't. And I can't even understand it, because usually if you use humor, you're using it for a particular purpose. Well, there was no purpose here, and he doesn't know how to tell a joke, frankly.
You know, Mark, I think we agree on this. If there is a hall of shame of using humor in the courts, I think this is going to enter that hall. Do you agree with me?
Yes, this will be remembered long time.
Yes, this is going to be like the glove and OJ, Mark. I think it's going to be right up there, don't you?
Of course, if you're right and Mr. Zimmerman ultimately acquitted, then Mr. West won't wear it, but otherwise he's going to be wearing this for a long, long time.
All right, well, thank you for joining me, Mark. Always a pleasure to have you on.
Not at all. Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
From local caseloads to the Supreme Court of Canada, this is Closing Arguments with Stephen Skirka on News Talk 1010.
And just before we continue, I'd like to mention to all of you that I'll be taking a summer hiatus from the Closing Arguments show, and I wanted to thank you for being with me as loyal listeners. I do enjoy your emails and comments. I want to thank the technician who's been with me since the beginning, Mike Catherwood. I want to thank my director, Jordana, my daughter, who is preceded by my son, Dylan, who's in summer camp right now. He was a fine director as well. So thank you to everyone. I didn't want to end this show without doing that, and I made sure that happened. So we have another special guest. I mean, we're just moving from one great guest to another, and I want to welcome Kirk Makin to Closing Argument. Good to have you with us, Kirk.
Hi, Stephen.
And Kirk, for those of you who don't know, is one of the most distinguished journalists in this country. He's been covering the criminal justice system for the Globe and Mail for decades and covered some of my cases personally. I remember the Dee Brown racial profiling case being one of them, Kirk. And,
yep.
And just right at the top, I mean, you've really set the gold standard. And as you know, I don't give false praise, but I am just going to miss you. I know I speak on behalf of a lot of people, and just want to thank you for your enormous contribution as a journalist.
That's incredibly kind, Steve. Thanks.
I want to ask you if you could just encapsulate, I know it's a difficult question, but just take us through some of the most interesting stories, Kirk, that you were fortunate enough to be there for, to cover as an eyewitness of history. What would you point to if you had to, say, for example, take your top three stories? What would they be?
Well, I guess just off the top, in some ways, Charter of Rights decisions that really changed the course of our jurisprudence were especially interesting to me. And sometimes they dealt with aspects of evidence, you know, of search and seizures that might not grab the average person, but they're very exciting to cover. But the ones I think that I need to go to when I'm answering a question like that are some of the trials, because those are the ones that people understand well and will remember. And certainly at the top of my list, the Guy Paul Morin trial was an ongoing labor of love for me for years. I covered it, in effect, for about 2 years simply as a court case, and then a year of it being an inquiry after his wrongful conviction for murder after his conviction was overturned and it was shown that it was, and he was exonerated. The Morin case was a remarkable case. It was only the second wrongful conviction that we'd had in the country. Donald Marshall was the first. And there was this whole tableau of Morin having lived right beside the victim, this young girl, Christine Jessup. And at his first trial, everyone thought he was going to be convicted, and he was acquitted. And then he, at his second trial, everyone thought he was going to be acquitted, and he was convicted. So it was a highly unpredictable case. Morin is a fascinating character. I ended up, you know, living with him more than I lived with my family toward the end while writing a book. And
I just want to, I remember one part of your book that I found fascinating, and that was the petition to keep Morin in custody, not get bail. I've never forgotten that petition. I wonder what all those people must be thinking who saw
it. There was such certitude that he was the guy. I mean, people really do, for any number of reasons, fix on someone's guilt or someone's innocence, and it just becomes sort of, you know, a dinner table topic. And when they go to trial, there's this, you know, juries, I think, are often questioned, you know, when they end up with a verdict that's against what everyone expected. People think, what on earth, what happened with the jury? And what the juries will tell you is, you guys and the public only knew half the story, and we finally got the real story in court, and it wasn't what the media and the public believed it to be.
So let's go to your next story.
Certainly one instance of that.
Let's go to your next story, Kirk.
Bernardo, I guess, would have to be the second one, another extremely famous case. In that case, everybody was convinced he was guilty, and for good reason. I mean, he was clearly guilty. But there was nonetheless going to be a trial, because that's the way our system works. And it ended up being a trial, in effect, of his partner, his wife, Carla Homolka, who, as many people will recall, had got herself a sweet plea bargain, blamed everything on Paul, and then when videotapes showing torture of the victims surfaced, it began to look as if maybe Carla had been a lot more involved than anyone ever thought. So that trial was a stunning development in court reporting and in really the criminal justice system. I'll never forget the lineup of 60 or 70 journalists every day just trying to get in there and get seated in the court, and hundreds of people outside the court. They actually had to issue tickets. People would line up at 5 a.m. To get in there just to bear witness to this.
Kirk, one quick question about Bernardo before we move to your next story. Did he get a fair trial?
Oh, I think he got a very fair trial. It really was one of the crowning glories of the criminal justice system. There was an exceptionally good judge who presided over it, made sure that it was done very fairly. It took several weeks. I mean, it was a draining experience for everybody. It took place right in the middle of summer, and it was sort of like the whole country was, you know, immersed in this this national bath of, you know, shame and horror that summer as the evidence came out. Bernardo certainly had his day in court, and he was represented by one of the finest counsel in the country, John Rosen. And Carla Homolka had to stand on that witness stand for 6 or 7 days and be questioned. So, you know, the system can't do much better than that.
All right, so let's move to your next story, Kirk.
It's kind of a funny one that you might be surprised by, but the Ernst Zundel trial was just a remarkable page in legal history. He was the Holocaust revisionist. located in Toronto. He had a small group of followers, and they were essentially trying to show that the Holocaust had never happened. We don't hear too much from those people anymore nowadays, but back in 84, 85, it was making headlines. And Zundel was a fascinating character in that, on the one hand, he was like a caricature. He wore this hard hat that said freedom of speech on it, and he had this little posse of fellow soldiers with their little hard hats that said free speech on them. But he was, the guy probably had an IQ of 180 because he knew how to play the system like nobody else. He played the media, he played the court system, he played his opponents. He got an enormous amount of publicity for his damn cause. And, you know, I often thought afterward that if the acumen he had shown in marketing his product, which was, Holocaust revisionism or denial, if he had been able to apply that to some really worthwhile social issue, he could have been, he could have been getting the Order of Canada right now instead of sitting in a prison cell in Germany.
Just have a couple of minutes, Kirk. Some of the interesting people you met along the way during your years as a journalist at the Globe?
Well, I mean, I have to tell you that a lot of the lawyers are pretty damn interesting people. We have some very colorful and very smart lawyers in this country. One of the things that as a journalist you get to do is you're rubbing shoulders with and you're getting to know sometimes on a friendly level. The top people in one of our most remarkable professions. I've gotten to know so many judges over the years. I knew lots of judges at the Supreme Court of Canada. People who have created court rulings that will be followed in jurisprudence for decades to come. People like Ian Binney, Claire Lura Dubay, Chief Justice Antonio Lemaire. In the legal profession itself, people like Eddie Greenspan and Clayton Ruby and yourself, Mark Sandler, there's so many really fascinating and very smart lawyers out there.
Well, I will end it on this, though, Kirk. I can tell you the lawyers and judges who you just named, those men and women only talked to you, only trusted you because of your integrity and your skill, and you earned that as a journalist, and I want to wish you all the best success in your next endeavor. And as I said, Kirk, we'll miss you, but thank you for sharing some of your experiences with us today on Closing Argument.
I can't thank you enough, Stephen. Thank you very, very much.
All right.
Covering the legal landscape in Canada, you're listening to Closing Arguments with criminal defense lawyer Stephen Skirka on News Talk 1010.
And welcome back. I should announce that this is Pride Week in Toronto, and today, of course, is the Pride Parade, which I understand is still going on in downtown Toronto. And how appropriate it is to have our next guest on the show, Andrew Feldstein. Good to have you with us again, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, Stephen.
So big developments this week in same-sex marriage south of the border, but there were some interesting developments on our side of the border relating to same-sex divorce and essentially same-sex marriage. So let's start with the Canadian situation, Andrew. What did Parliament do in relation to same-sex divorce that's significant?
Well, if you remember last year, there was a controversy because the lawyer for the federal government took the position that a same-sex marriage that took place in Canada for residents that did not live in Canada, that they were not allowed to get a divorce here in Canada. And they took two reasons why they said they couldn't get a divorce in Canada. The first reason, which was the more difficult reason to understand, was to say the marriage wasn't valid. And they took that position because they said in order for marriage to be valid, it had to be valid where the marriage took place, which was here, and it had to be valid in the place where the parties lived. And in that case, the marriage wasn't valid in that place. And the former Justice Minister, Erwin Kotler, actually got into the mix and said the amendments that were drafted when he was a Justice Minister had corrected that problem, so in his view, the marriages were valid here in Canada. The second ground that these people took to say that the divorce wasn't, or that the government of Canada wouldn't allow a divorce, was based on the fact that you have to live in a province in Canada for 1 year prior to commencing a divorce. And clearly, if they got married here because they weren't living here and they still weren't living here, then they didn't meet that test. But nonetheless, these people tried to get a divorce. And the legislation fixed it by saying, if you can't get a divorce in the place that you lived, that you currently live in, and you were married here in Canada, providing you both agree, you can get a divorce in Canada now.
All right. And we should say, Andrew, that despite what happened in the United States Supreme Court this week, most states in America still don't uphold same-sex marriage. Am I right about that?
The majority? Absolutely. The overwhelming majority don't allow for same-sex marriage. I think it's about 37 states.
All right. So let's move to the two decisions released this week by the U.S. Supreme Court, one with DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. So why don't we start with that, Andrew? What did the court decide there?
Well, in that case, the court had to deal with whether same-sex marriage couples should be entitled to the benefits that married couples are entitled to. And in that case, it was a 5-4 decision, but the court decided to treat same-sex couples in the same way as married couples. So they have equal rights under U.S. federal law. So they can file joint tax return, they can get the married deduction, they can get Social Security benefits and survivor benefits.
So it's not just a symbolic victory. This has actual real significance, monetary significance to people in these kinds of same-sex marriage situations, right, Andrew?
Absolutely. I think it's an overwhelming victory for them because now they're not just considered married, but they're being treated married under the law with some very real and significant benefits.
All right. So the more important decision in terms of the publicity that it received, Andrew, was the Proposition 8 case out of California. Can you just give us some background about what that case related to?
Well, that was a proposition that dealt with California voters saying that gay marriage should not be allowed in the state of California. And that proposition was actually successful, and that meant in the state of California, gay marriage was not permitted. And it worked its way up the courts, and the U.S. Supreme Court, again in a 5-4 decision, has said that Proposition 8 would be set aside, and therefore same-sex marriages would be allowed in the state of California.
But it, you know, one of the things that's missing from an analysis of the case, and it's a wonderful victory for those people affected in the state of California, but it wasn't decided on a basis of equality. It was really on a narrow jurisdictional basis that they didn't have standing to really argue it in the first place. Am I right about that?
Well, the interesting part there was the state of California was the one who should have been arguing to uphold the legislation. But as I understand it, the state of California wasn't. And then the special interest group that supported the proposition was the one that wanted to get standing, and they were denied standing.
Right. So you had David Boies and Ted Olson, two brilliant lawyers coming from opposite ends of the political spectrum, and indeed they'd argued on the opposite side of the Gore-Bush U.S. Supreme Court case that decided an American presidency. They were the ones who brought this, and ultimately, because the state of California hadn't introduced it, it was just say, look, there's just an issue of standing here. We can't deal with it, and so that was the victory. But really, the court had an opportunity and missed it, didn't it? As our Court of Appeal did about 10 years ago, to make a pronounced, strong statement about the importance of equality as a constitutional value that should uphold same-sex marriage.
I agree with you on that statement. However, you have to remember that that a good number of the appointments on the U.S. Supreme Court are Republican appointments.
Yeah.
So if you had wanted them to make that kind of statement, the result may not have been a 5-4 result, and it may have been something that people wouldn't be happy with.
Andrew,
this may have been the linchpin to get somebody over.
You know, I think in this case, the courts are irrelevant. This is a force that's coming, and if people aren't willing to accept it, I know there was a victory today, against the Republican opponents of this decision. But I mean, it just has too much public appeal, too much force, and it's going to come. And I think in the same way abortion did. That's my own personal view, Andrew.
Well, even in the U.S. now, you're seeing polls showing that the majority of Americans are now in support of same-sex marriage.
What's you're an experienced family law lawyer. What's the landscape like? How many same-sex marriages, for example, have we had in this country?
Well, it's interesting because there's about 45,000 same-sex couples in Canada, and there's 54% are married gays and 46% are married lesbians. Only 16%, though, have children, being same-sex couples with children. And I think that's the next area that we're going to see great movement in, that the legislature really has to deal with, is how are we going to treat the children when people are getting other people to be sperm donors and things of that nature.
So that's the next step of litigation that you foresee. And what about, we talked about same-sex divorces. Is that a predominant issue in Canada?
Well, for people who are resident here, it's now become no different than any other divorce case.
So it's treated the same. If you were a Canadian resident, and for example, even before this legislation was passed, and you'd had a same-sex marriage here, you'd been here for at least a year, your divorce would have been treated the same way as a heterosexual couple seeking divorce.
Absolutely. There's no real difference other than the fact when you're working through the case, you just have to be cognizant that of the names you call people, you're better to use first names than saying husband and wife.
Andrew, we were a decade ahead of America in the same-sex marriage debate in terms of the way the courts dealt with it. Well, why do you think that was? Why do you think that we were really so far ahead on this issue of social justice than our American counterparts? Is it political or is it more than that?
I think it's a bit of both, because we also had lawyers who were prepared to take this issue and run with it 10 years ago. And I also think that the lawyers who took it and ran with it obviously had to feel that the political landscape of the judiciary would be sympathetic to the cause.
Yeah. Well,
whereas I think in the U.S. they probably were more reluctant to do that.
Do you think it also was the nature of the constitutional document itself, that our charter really, I think, invited this argument, that it was just such an overwhelming point when you looked at the various sections of the charter that it affected?
I'm sure it did affect it, but I question if this argument had happened in the earlier days of the charter, whether we would have had the same result.
Do you think it's more of just catching up with public opinion and public perception, and the courts eventually have to do that?
I think with this type of situation, I think that's part of it happening. I actually, it's funny, a few months ago I was out for dinner with my family law professor from law school, and I told him he was the first person I ever heard who was talking about same-sex marriage was when I was taking family law in law school, and that was in the early 1990s. And most of the students in the class when we were talking about it thought of it as a far-fetched idea.
What do you think the next far-fetched idea that we're going to be tackling will be, Andrew?
Well, I'm happy to say this one we tackled, and we tackled it successfully. But the next one, as I said before, when you're getting into same-sex marriage, has to deal with what's going to happen with sperm donors and what's going to happen when the sperm donor says he wants to see the children, or what's going to happen when the parent of a child who had a sperm donor says, I want child support from that child, because I think there's very solid grounds to say that parent should get child support under the current law, and I think there's solid grounds that person who may want access may get access. And I think the legislature, since it's a provincial issue, needs to deal with that.
Okay, needs
to act to give people the groundwork of something that they want so that they can understand when they're making these decisions what the ramifications are.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Good to
Thanks
have you
for having
with you.
Me again.
And thank you, everyone, for listening and sharing part of your Sunday afternoons with me. I'm Steve Skirka, and you've been listening to Closing Arguments.